Greetings, race community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Suzanne Hilser-Wiles, who serves as president at Brenzebach Lear & Associates, also known as GG&A. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
Well, I've been looking forward to hosting you. I've had the opportunity to spend time together at a variety of cases and other events over the years. But, one of the catalysts for starting the podcast is that so often in those discussions, we start with, where are you now? Where are you going from here? And we don't get to spend a lot of time on what your journey has been. And so I would love to know more about the path that led you into your advancement leadership. And I've been doing that by asking our guests to tell me a little bit more about their own education experience. So take me back to junior year of high school. Who is that Suzanne? What was she into? And what led you to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill?
I went to a small girls boarding school in the Northeast, and that I think was a truly seminal experience because it was cool to be a girl who was smart and a leader. And that I think really set me up not only for success, but with a community of like-minded women. And I'm still very close to many of the people I went to high school with. We're very connected and have been real cheerleaders for each other's success along the way.
Well, let's give the high school a real shout out, the master's school. I've got to tell you, kind of a fun intersection with Evertrue is one of my very first teammates joined us after working at the master's school and then working at Carney Sando and Associates, which is, a search firm that is really leader in the independent school world. Her name was Courtney Camps at the time, now Courtney Toomey. And Courtney absolutely raved about her experience working at the master's school. Tell me about your student experience.
Sure. Well, and one of the interesting things is the school has gone co-ed since then, which is 100% the right decision for the institution. I would say one of the challenges for institutions like Dobbs, the master's school, is that women like me have such a strong affiliation for something that isn't part of the setup at the school right now. Although I want to give them credit for, I think they've really tried to communicate to the alumni what they are doing to continue to foster that feeling of leadership in young women in particular. So, it really was a tremendous experience. I had a lot of opportunity to build community, to lead different organizations, to see what I was interested in, passionate about in the world. We had some really extraordinary professors there, faculty members. In fact, I start to say history professor because this year on Juneteenth, I did a post on LinkedIn where I mentioned my history professor who taught us, way back in the 80s about Juneteenth and what an extraordinary teacher she was and so forward thinking. And it got a lot of reaction from people in that kind of master school community, which was really fun.
I love it. And so tell me about the college search. The world was your oyster. Did you have an aspiration or a connection to North Carolina what led you there?
Well, I had spent time in North Carolina. My family has had a home there for most of my life. And so I really loved the place. But most importantly, it wasn't so much that I was so taken with Chapel Hill, to be honest. It was more I recognized, coming from the small girl school, growing up in New York, I just needed to broaden my horizons. I needed to not go to the same kinds of schools all my friends and family members were looking at. I tell people it's the one moment of clarity I had as a 17-year-old. I need to break out of this. I need to do something more expansive. And I've not regretted that decision for a second. It really was life-changing. I had an extraordinary college experience. I met my husband, my best friend to this day. I learned a lot, and I feel like it did open up my eyes to, what a broader world looked like. And I think that also set me up to continue to explore that and to feel like I can move out of my comfort zone. I went from a a class of 90 young women to 3,000 people from all over the world. And it was a big transition, but it was an exciting one and one that was well worth the payoff.
I grew up in Iowa, went to Brown, and I remember having a couple friends for the first time in my life from New York City was so cool. And they, brought us down a couple times and knew how to navigate the whole thing. Did you ever get to play big city host during the college experience?
So I'm from Westchester County, right outside the city. And I absolutely did. Brought friends from school.
A lot of Times Square pictures. You're like, we never go to Times Square. They're like, I don't care. We're going to Times Square, right? Basically.
Yeah. Well, and I was just telling this story to somebody when I grew up in the late 70s and 80s, Times Square was not particularly safe either. So we, we'd go to the movies, but it was, between some questionable businesses. but I did. And that was really fun. And, conversely, I got to see where they grew up. I remember going to the wedding of a college friend in a rural farming community in North Carolina and getting to see what her life had been like. And that was really exciting and fun. And I think fed my curiosity about the world, having had that experience. And I appreciated that growing up, you think, well, this is the world. And then you leave home like you did in a big way. And you're like, oh, no, this is my tiny world.
Right.
And most people's worlds actually don't look like this.
And my understanding is that I also sort of stumbled into the advancement world by way of volunteerism. Yeah. And it sounds like you did as well.
I did. Right after college, I took a job in investment banking, which I hated. And I was a board member.
Which firm were you?
I worked for a small firm called Montgomery Securities that was subsequently bought by B of A.
And so tell me more about that work. I don't think we've had too many investment banking, analysts on the show.
Yeah.
It's really hard to describe. I did the same thing for 2 years, Suzanne.
Yeah. Well, let me say, actually, it set me up super well for GG&A because we are a very data-driven organization. And the head of our business development team tells me sometimes that he feels that my advantage in the firm is that I can do math in my head. So it's a very intense experience. It's super smart people, but it's really solving at the end of the day, I can say, well, I think the firm was very strong. I learned a lot. I think they were providing value. It wasn't things I was particularly interested in. A big project I worked on was looking at how best to divest branches of a regional bank as they were closing and looking at a different business model. It was important for them to have a lot of really great analytics around that. It was not something that fed my soul. So I was a board member of a small AIDS organization. This was the mid-90s in San Francisco. That felt super meaningful. And I was offered a promotion at the investment firm. And I, in the meeting, spontaneously just said, I think you should give this job to somebody who wants to be here. And my boss said, are you here to write a book about us? I said, Scott, with all due respect, you are not interesting enough to fill a book. but honestly, being offered a promotion, as you know, that's really kind of then writing your ticket to, do you want to go to Stanford Business School? Do you want to go to Harvard Business School? And none of that interested me. So after having to have many conversations with my parents about why that did not interest me,
this is a quarter life crisis, what we're describing.
Right, right. Exactly. I was way ahead of the curve, Brent. subsequent to that, I was I helped this AIDS organization get a grant from an individual donor, another board member, to hire their first ever development position. And so the CEO came to me and said, you actually got this gift for us. And you don't like being a banker. wouldn't you love to take an enormous pay cut and come do this? And I was like, you know, I think I would actually. So I did.
So that was it. And you joined that organization.
I did. And it was tiny. And it was definitely an all hands on deck. So I got to do
those bankers thing. Like, she's lost it.
They thought I had lost my mind. You know, I think they thought my boss, who was fantastic, and he was, you know, not that much older than me, he's a few years out of business school. He said, look, if you change your mind, let us know. But then he and I talked about it. And he said, you know, I don't think you're going to change your mind. So he ended up being super supportive too. Especially as I talked to him about why I was so excited about this other thing and why a bank, which just wasn't an investment bank, just wasn't the right fit for me. I think he could see that.
And so tell me about, I mean, huge transition. You're now at the small mm-hmm. nonprofit.
Yep.
Any second guessing along the way, or you're just all systems go, let's do this.
No, you know, I think that the biggest driver and why I love consulting, the biggest driver for me professionally is curiosity. And so I didn't have any second guessing because I had so much to learn, not only about fundraising, and I had been a volunteer fundraiser for my high school since I graduated. So I've been doing volunteer fundraising, but not only learning about fundraising, but also, you know, learning about nonprofit management. You know, we were a 5-person staff. We all had to wear multiple hats. Understanding how the AIDS crisis and the development of early drugs was changing the face of that community. Figuring out how to work in the Castro, which is where our offices were, where I did not look like most people who were working in the neighborhood or who were working for AIDS organizations at the time. So navigating all of that and trying to do that with respect and care was so stimulating that I never look back.
When did you return to New York?
We moved to New York in the late 90s for my husband to go to graduate school at Columbia. And so after this, you know, small nonprofit experience, I thought, well, this is as far as I'm going to get being self-taught. I got to go where people know more than me. And that is, you know, well, virtually at that point, almost anywhere. But I purposefully decided I wanted to work for a big organization. And my undergraduate degree was in art history. So I interviewed a number of places and ultimately I accepted a position at MoMA, which was a huge privilege.
Tell me about MoMA. Tell me about museum fundraising, mm-hmm. similarities and differences, right? If you're going to lead advancement at Chapel Hill, you've got a relatively defined population of supporters to screen and engage, and, you know, parents may be cycling through, but fairly defined versus, you know, literally every single day at MoMA, your lead pool is growing.
Yeah.
And so just walk me through that. We haven't had too many museum founders on the podcast.
Yeah, it's a really great question. And I think you put your finger on some of what makes it different. So I worked at MoMA for 3 years and I worked at the Metropolitan Museum of Art for 3 years. You know, I think that's what you just described is both the plus and the minus, right? Anybody could be your constituent. At the same time, you don't have an inherent relationship with anybody, including a former trustee, right? Your alma mater is always your alma mater, even if you didn't like it, even if you've had a falling out. But your museum is not always your museum. And I think the need to continue to engage people all the time, every day, even if they've had a significant relationship like trustee, is one of the differences. So yes, you've got this enormous opportunity, but you also have to work to keep people feeling like this is their museum. The other thing is, I think the importance of the director is different at a museum. You know, we work with a lot of really big, complex institutions. Not to say the president isn't very important at those, they are. But again, because if it's my alma mater, it's my alma mater through multiple presidencies, People do make different kinds of decisions on their engagement with an arts organization, depending on who's in charge. So that's another thing. I think the importance of the CEO and how they're seen is just has a different weight at an arts organization. And, you know, arts organizations, even the largest, a lot of their fundraising historically has come from trustees. So you have a model where you have some really extraordinary gifts from trustees, a very broad, low-level giving group, and probably not as well-developed major gifts program. And, you know, that's also different. And that's shifting as institutions, the need for private support is growing. But how to create that program without upsetting the apple cart on the two parts that probably have been doing really well, your low-level giving membership programs and your trustee giving. That's something we work a lot with clients on.
I recently hosted a couple of people who have had experience in like the opera fundraising space, for example. And yep. One of the things that they shared is that there are some really kind of amazing behind the scenes stewardship experiences that are curated, where, you know, the sort of parlor dinner where, you know, small group performances, like what were some of the, I don't know, special stewardship experiences that stand out in that museum world that you experienced?
So the best stewardship moment I will ever be a part of in my entire career, I am sure, happened at MoMA. While the museum was closed and before it moved to a temporary residence in Queens during renovations, the Picasso painting, Mademoiselle d'Avignon, Mademoiselle d'Avignon, was being conserved. So it was in the conservation lab. And so we were able to bring a small group of people to get very close and to hear about this, you know, iconic painting being preserved. And it was incredible to be that close to it, to hear the conservation experts, the curator talk about what was being done to make sure that this incredibly important work in the history of modern art was preserved for future generations was extraordinary. I mean, every person, no matter how, like, no matter what their own collection looked like, left the room like in total awe and excitement, as did I. I mean, that was a real privilege to be part of that. So those kind of opportunities to hear about these things that are, you know, that's not just a painting that people who care about art know about. That's just a painting that most people, even if they don't know the name, and I just botched the name, even if they don't know the name, they'll see it and know I've seen that before. So that's a really amazing thing. We also got to go before it was open to the public, the Glass House in Philip Johnson's Glass House in Connecticut was opened for us to a small group of donors. So getting to see some of these really iconic works, either when they weren't available to the public or, you know, in a different way than the public was able to experience them was really extraordinary. And as somebody who studied art in college, it was really special.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing. And tell me just about the intersection of the art world and like social life and the whole social life thing. Like, I don't know a lot about it, but you see it every year, right? And it feels like it gets bigger and bigger because of social media.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
but it, you know, it has to just be a tremendous amount of sort of earned media, if you will, right? Free advertising, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you feel about the glitz and glam relative to the history and the, I don't know, authenticity of the art?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question. And, you know, having worked at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, every person in the development team had to work every year on the party of the year. So that is, of course, the most extreme example of what you're talking about, this really just kind of celebrity filled moment that is covered in every fashion magazine, every lifestyle magazine. You know, it's interesting because that was a very successful fundraiser for the Met's Costume Institute. It also brought a lot of attention in a positive way to the Met's Costume Institute. So in that case, you do have something that has a very public kind of outfacing messaging, but it is tied to the mission specifically. It is tied to the Costume Institute. So, and it raises important money for the Costume Institute. So I think there it made sense, and it was a win for the museum, not only for the dollars, but also because it really tied to the mission in a specific way. We were also really careful, I would say, when I worked at the Met. I worked in corporate fundraising, so we had a lot of corporations coming to us wanting to do things associated with the Met. And I was very proud of the trustees and the leadership, and that I think they were really thoughtful about where were the appropriate places for the Met to partner? What were the ways that seemed aligned with mission? And that was a serious conversation there. You know, one of the things that's interesting is a lot of those, you know, that's what's covered by the media, right? Those big parties. And but in my experience, having worked at, you know, two of the largest and I would say best museums in the world, the people who are deeply engaged, who are trustees, even if there is a social cachet to being on those, they really care about the art. They are collectors themselves. They care about the collection. They are really thoughtful in what they're doing, not only to preserve, but also to make accessible these works of art. You know, those for people not familiar with the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Temple of Dendor, which is in lots of movies, right? And it's this beautiful temple that's preserved there. The reason that it's in a glass house and is so that it's accessible to the public. You don't have to go in the museum to see it.
Okay, I will let you preemptively plead the fifth on this, but you've got 3 hours in New York and you can only go to one of those two museums. What are you going to and why?
I think it really depends on what kind of art you like. So, and what I would great, also suggest.
Great way to dodge that answer.
If you should always not only look at the highlights, but ask the guards, what do people most want to see when they come here? And at both institutions, the guards are, first of all, extraordinarily like friendly and client and customer service oriented, but many of them know a lot about the art. And that's so amazing. They can tell you, like, go see these things.
All right, everybody listening. Next museum, ask the guard. You heard it here first. That is a secret. Thank you. Okay, let's talk about your move to cancer care. You have such a neat breadth of experience, you know, not only through your consulting work, but you've worked in different verticals. So like, what was it like transitioning? Very different mission, impact. Yeah. I gotta believe a very different fundraising model. What stands out from that time?
So while I worked at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, I was treated for a rare form of ovarian cancer. So I was myself at that point a cancer survivor. When I was ill, my daughter was two. So we really, I would say, and it was obviously an incredibly difficult time, but one of the things that came out of that for my husband and I was an appreciation for how much more manageable that experience was because of the extraordinary privilege we had in our life. And I don't just mean we had great insurance and access to healthcare. We lived in New York City. You know, I was treated at Memorial Sloan Kettering. I had this rare cancer. It was a cancer they'd seen a bunch of times because they're a comprehensive cancer center. But we also had friends and family. I had an employer that was extraordinarily supportive of me. So we had all of these resources to make this terrible situation manageable. So we had been talking about that and what could we do to be giving back. And my former boss at MoMA called me because she was friends with a donor at MoMA who was a board member at Cancer Care. And they were looking to bring in somebody to help them kind of rethink what they had been doing in fundraising. And they my friend Lisa had told this board member about my background, and she said, please have her apply. Now, I want to share a story here because I think it's important in thinking about women and career management. I got the job description and I went to my husband. I said, I'm not qualified for this job. I don't have all the things. And he said to me, Suzanne, a board member asked you to apply after hearing about this. What are you doing? Like, this is not up to you to self-select. If they don't think you're qualified, they're going to let you know that, but why would you not apply? And I'm not sure I would have if he hadn't actually pointed that out to me. So I think that's something that a lot of particularly young women do. They decide for themselves, I'm not qualified, and they shouldn't. And so I got the job and I worked there for 4 years. It was a phenomenal experience. I'm still...
I spoke with one of my teammates, Laura Austin, who is our creative director. She's been with us for over 7 years. I mean, we basically we've gone from not having kids to growing together basically. And it's been an amazing run. And she let me know that she's going to be moving on from Evertrue and has a new opportunity. And I said to her then, and I'll say now, I'm both so happy for her, sad for us, but, But she shared the same thing. It's a big leap for her. And, she used the expression imposter syndrome. And I think that, it sounds like that's some of what you were navigating. And I think, right, there's absolutely zero reason not to just go for it. And worst case scenario, you don't get it or you get it and it doesn't work out. And similar to your old boss in banking, there's going to be other options as you've built trust in relationships like you had at that point. Sounds like the combination of support from your husband and the inspiration or push from the board really made it happen.
It did, yeah. And Cancer Care is in this organization that offers free psychosocial support for people with cancer and their caregivers. So it really did speak to exactly what my husband and I had identified as some of that, what made our experience so much more manageable. So it's free psychosocial support and then other support services like education programs. There was some financial aid for things like, gas cards to get to treatment, things that people don't always think about can be real barriers to getting the treatment that you need. So I went there. I followed somebody who'd been in the role for about 17 years. So really was charged with coming in and helping them think about, there's a lot of foundation support and corporate support, particularly from pharma, from other companies that were working in that space. Not as much individual giving. So I worked with very closely with a wonderful colleague, Liz Fitzgerald, who's now a very senior person at ACLU, and really helped kind of redesigned the individual giving program, which was, the biggest difference was I went from a place that had about 2,000 employees to a place that had about 100 employees. So, being on a 4-person senior leadership team, so my ability to influence where the organization was going through the philanthropic lens, but also outside of it, just as part of the senior leadership team, really helped me grow as a manager, as a leader, and in thinking about how do we make decisions at this organization that influence my program, but maybe are right for the organization, but wouldn't be the ones I'd made if it were just about my program. So I feel like I got to learn a lot. My daughter was a client at the time. They did these extraordinary programs for children. One of her best friends from preschool developed leukemia and passed away. And so the grief counseling that my daughter got was really life-changing for her. I think that experience of both benefiting from cancer care services and being able to make sure that they were provided to the widest possible group of people was probably the most personally impactful one I'll have in my professional life.
Let me ask you about like cancer care as a category in the nonprofit world. I was just taking a quick look, and it looks like there are over 3,900 cancer-related nonprofits. A lot of those are really, really small, but let's say there's at least 200 with over 10 employees or more, roughly. And there's kind of, like, I didn't know much about cancer care until preparing for this and, you know, learning the background. And it sounds, I mean, you just said, like, as emotional and rewarding of an impact as your entire career. But putting it bluntly, it also sounds like a whole bunch of other nonprofits. And so it's not like creating a brand and identity that goes beyond like cancer is bad. Everybody can get behind that at a high level.
Right.
I'm thinking about as a philanthropist, do I want to back cancer care or this group or that group or go to Dana-Farber directly?
Sure.
Like same general overarching mission.
Yeah,
I guess part of my question is like, should there be 200 cancer organizations
yeah.
over 10, you know, employees in the nonprofit space, or
yeah.
do we need more like super cancer organizations that can find resources? And like, how do you think about the fragmentation of the nonprofit world?
Yeah, that's a it's a really interesting question, particularly in the cancer space. And as you point out, there are thousands and thousands, most of which are founded by somebody with cancer or somebody who loved them and are very small. And one of the things we always encourage people at cancer care when they were like, I want to give back, it's like, it doesn't have to be a cancer care, but please do see if somebody else is already addressing the issue that you think is they're not, right? There's research we can help you with to connect you with that place rather than recreating it. And, you know, it's a very emotional response for people to something that is completely out of their control. They or someone they love has a devastating disease, right? So it comes from a good place. It's not always the most practical response. So at Cancer Care, we work closely with the Live Strong Foundation, American Cancer Society, some of the big cancer providers, particularly in and around New York, to make sure that what we did was additive and not duplicative. So that was there is that kind of coordination at the high level. So for instance, Cancer Care does a lot of these kind of one sheets, like tips for caregivers and that kind of thing. I have now, having been, you know, lived in different parts of the country, I've seen those cancer care materials in lots of other cancer centers where they don't have the resources to create those for themselves. So I do think there is at the higher level coordination. It's probably not as much as there should be, but we always try to be very mindful of that. Particularly thinking about like American Cancer Society, Live Strong, how could we work together? In fact, at one point, Live Strong, they got a lot of requests from people for counseling. So we had counselors who were like basically immediate patch through so that we could be providing that with licensed social workers, which they didn't have the staff to do, but so that it was seamless. So there was a lot of really good work to try and make that happen. But you're right, there's not enough vetting. And I don't even know if there's like a resource for somebody like you want to give back. Yeah. What are the things you might think of to make sure that you're being additive and not duplicative?
Okay, let's bring it full circle to your investment banking days. Should there be more mergers and acquisitions? Should somebody be coming in and saying, you know what, I'm going to do a roll-up strategy and I'm going to find the five best, you know, aligned cancer-related nonprofits that, you know, if we could consolidate the overhead and, you know, broaden the value proposition, it would be even more compelling to the existing donor base. You know, is there like a synergies story that, you know, should be realized in this space the way that it has in pretty much every other sector? You're seeing, you know, at the kind of edges of higher education, there have been more
some mergers, you
know, mergers, but it's really out of failure as opposed to out of strength, right? Where in the commercial world, it's constantly looking at like, how can we be stronger from a position, you know, even stronger starting from a position of strength versus a college is going out of business, who's going to take it over?
Yeah.
And does that exist? Do you see that in the nonprofit world?
You know, I do. And so you asked two different questions. Do I think there should be this? Do I see it? Yes, I do think there should be this. Do I see it? I would echo what you just said. I think it's often because an organization is failing, not because they're thinking about how can we partner with this organization to create some efficiencies. And also, so therefore we are, you know, able to, we are able to live into our mission in a more impactful way.
Well, I think it's fair to say it's the only $1 trillion sector in our economy that doesn't have a leading M&A banker. So maybe there's something.
Yeah. There you go, Brent. I think you and I just started our new business.
You know, I've been looking for a side hustle. So this
Yeah, me too. Call. Not enough going on. Yeah. Well, I, you know, it's interesting. I think about this in all areas of our sector too, right? On the for-profit side, I think we all need to be thinking about all the time, how best do we fulfill on our missions? How are we partnering? Where are there opportunities to work together? If we're all so entrenched in our way, my lane, then we can't get better as organizations and we can't get better as companies that work with these organizations.
Yeah, I mean, look, I wasn't trying to sort of bring it full circle to our story, but having led an M&A strategy in the software part of the advancement and nonprofit space over the last couple of years, where we brought together Evertruth, ThankView, a fund accounting system called FundDriver, the Solus Group, which was doing Tableau reporting, and then a firm called PledgeMind, which is doing really compelling on-demand personalized print, and bringing all of that together has been, I mean, it's been amazing. Like there's definitely been, you know, ups and downs as you'll inevitably have, but in a certain sense, like we have seen the ability to broaden what our vision can become, you know, put together packages with the different relative strengths of those individual components that, you know, on a standalone basis, none of us were able to walk in with as holistic viewpoint. And it makes me wonder, like, is there a nonprofit version where, you know, if there are Venn diagram overlaps of five different nonprofits that could come together with more revenue, more resources, a bigger vision, you know, could the same kind of you know, really synergies be realized? And feels like yes, but I agree. I've not heard of anybody really doing this besides those higher ed edge cases.
And, you know, I think it really requires two things. It requires certainly creativity and being able to look at the problem in a slightly different way than perhaps you've been looking at it from your own lane. It also requires some humility. We may not know all of these answers. We may not be the best. And personal humility, if we merge with this, you know, organization, am I actually going to be the best person in my role? And I think that's where it falls apart, honestly.
Yeah. No, that's for sure. And we've had countless examples of you know, our teammates both exercising a tremendous amount of humility and also in a handful of situations realizing that sort of collective vision wasn't aligned with where they wanted to go. So
it's very
interesting. And, you know, I never know where we're going to end up on the podcast. We did not come about how to get here, but let's get to the real, you know, current scope of your work. You've been at GGNA for over 12 years. You know, tell me about joining the firm, some of your highlights, like the catalyst to join the firm.
Yeah.
And then ultimately the opportunity to step up into the president role.
So I was working for the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, a really wonderful conservatory in the UNC system. I'd been there for 4 years, and the university really, the leadership really wanted to prepare for a campaign. And so I had a moment where I thought I either need to commit to this campaign or I need to think about something else. For a lot of reasons, that wasn't staying for the campaign was not the right thing for me. And so just as I was sort of having that realization, I got a call from a recruiter I had worked with before at Lindauer. And they said, this is not something we've talked to you about before, but would you be interested? This firm, GG&A, is looking for a pool of consultants to come in at this point. They want to bring in people who might become next generation leadership for the firm. And so the interesting thing is, I am pretty sure to this day, I'm the only person, only consultant GG&A has ever hired whom nobody knew before, because I had largely worked in the arts. And so I was completely unknown to the firm, which is, again, very unusual given the breadth and depth of the reach. So I was intrigued. I thought it would be fun. I didn't, you know, I thought if I left my current job, I could get a job at like a slightly bigger organization doing the same thing and hopefully move my way up. But ultimately, that sounded like kind of the same version of that job for the next 30 years. And that wasn't that interesting to me. So I was lucky enough to be hired by the firm and immediately got thrown into all sorts of projects where I didn't have as much experience, institutions that were totally new to me. John Glier and I still laugh about this. One of my very first projects with him was on a business school. For a business school, very prestigious business school. And knowing John, as you do, you will appreciate this. I called him and I said, oh, you know, I'm new. I think you have me confused with someone else. I don't have this experience. I'm sure you meant to put someone else on this project. And he was like, no. I know exactly what I'm doing, you know, get on the plane, I'll see you there. And got to learn a ton about business schools, and from John, which was really great. So over my 12 years at the firm, I really have worked with all sizes, types, sectors, in about 14 countries now. And it's been a tremendous opportunity to, you know, learn more about the nonprofit community, how it works all over the world, learn from clients. We have extraordinary clients. And, you know, what I love about it is I am really pushed to bring my A game every day. I have to do a lot of research and interviewing and homework to really make sure that I am understanding the client and bringing things to them that they don't already have. And these are sophisticated places. So, so that's my consulting life, which is still about half of the time that I spend with the firm.
When you think, so I have had the opportunity to spend time with many of your teammates, and I've had a chance to spend a little bit of time with John over the years. I don't know him that well, but definitely regular interactions, in, you know, by way of the conference circuit. In 2012, when Evertrue was like a little seed sort of starting to sprout, you know, somebody invited me to present at this GG&A staff conference in Chicago. And, you know, in hindsight, I have no idea what I was talking about at that time, but I just remember feeling like it was such a big milestone that like this firm would give me time at their, you know, staff. And we were probably talking about the growth of social media and platforms like LinkedIn and Facebook and how that was creating new ways to connect with people and new data signals. And I just remember it was like such a privilege to be there, but also I remember finishing being like, what did I just say? Cause there was a mix of like an excitement and sort of probably, but when you think about what the ingredients were, you know, what, when you think about the founding team, why did GG&A succeed? Like not only succeed, but really emerge as a leader. Like, what are the things about John or Martin or sort of founding team members that have led to, you know, where you are today, which is obviously going to evolve and continue to change, but you got to a leadership position. Why do you think that is?
So we actually spent a lot of time talking about this and really thinking about that, because particularly as we, you know, as colleagues and I kind of, you know, moved into leadership positions at the firm, what were the things that have driven that we want to maintain? And, you know, I think it actually comes down to two big things. The biggest is intellectual curiosity. So having you in at that moment is a great example. It the firm's, I think, approach to this isn't just what's established that our clients already know about, but what should we be thinking about? What should we be getting our clients to think about? So that curiosity about what's happening in the sector at all levels of established, I think, is a through line. And it's also something now we really look for as we interview people, because that's what makes somebody thrive, right? If they're really fed by that intellectual curiosity, then working at GG&A is exciting. And if they're not, it's a lot of work. So the second is humility. And I think we are really careful when we talk about, so for instance, in how we talk about our clients, and we understand we are there to help them succeed, but their success is their success. And also on the kind of day-to-day, understanding what you know and don't know enables you to ask the right questions and bring in the right colleagues and identify where more research is known, is needed. I think those things are really, I believe, a hallmark of the GG&A internal culture that has enabled us to continue to grow. And I think is very much embraced by the people at the firm, and those leaders who I hope will take us into the future.
What do you hope you can say 5 years from now, when you think about where the firm's going, where the industry is 5 years from now? We meet up on a podcast or maybe even in real life. What do you want to say?
Yeah. So I feel like being appointed the president of GG&A, which is, I'm the third person to have that title, is an extraordinary privilege. And 5 years from now, what I would like to be able to say is the team that is in senior leadership positions has taken this amazing foundation that was put in place by first John Grunzebach, Martin's father, John Gleer, Martin Grunzebach, and other leaders at the firm, and has helped it thrive in a way that continues to live into the mission of the firm, which is to help all of these amazing nonprofits and educational institutions make the world a better place. I tell our team all the time to get to work at a place that I truly believe helps make the world better in a for-profit setting. That's like a dream for somebody who is an investment banker and also has worked in nonprofit. So being able to continue to build on that extraordinary foundation and do it and helping even more organizations, that's what I hope we'll be able to achieve.
In a world where we're talking about billions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of donors at a campaign level, one thing that stood out for me with our team as we grow is those numbers getting bigger don't inspire, really, because like they're just numbers. Yeah. And what inspires people are individual stories. And it's almost like the bigger numbers they get, the smaller the stories can be, the more the impact can be felt. And I just want to close this conversation with a story that you shared in advance during your time at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, where you had an opportunity to like really change a life. And I think it's the kind of thing that I find so inspiring, and also just wonder, how do we kind of make that feeling more common in this world of philanthropy? So give us a story and let's see if we can, dry eyes, all right?
Yeah. So the school, it's a very small school. So we knew the students and the faculty leaders very well. The assistant dean of our School of Drama called me about a student who had been working really hard. He was not eligible for some government grants because of family situation. And he found out that he was going to need despite all of this planning, hard work, he painted dorms during the summer. He needed a different level of financial support because something had fallen through. And the assistant dean of the School of Drama called me. It was the first week of school. And he said, we have allocated all of our scholarship dollars. This is not a big place. We don't have a lot of extra. But this student, Daniel, is incredibly worthy student. Could you please help us? I happened to have meetings with several donors during the day and a small reception that was being hosted by our chair of our development committee. So throughout the day, I told people about Daniel's story and that we were hoping to be able to do this sort of emergency work to support him staying in school. And by the time that reception was over, we had the money that we needed. I called the assistant dean of the School of Drama. And that week, Daniel dropped off a handwritten note in my office to say, Dean Bassetta explained what you did, and you have enabled me to stay in school. And this is the most important thing to me and my mom, who has made so many sacrifices for me to be here. And it was obviously incredibly impactful. And I think what I shared with you is I kept it on my desk. And whenever I was having a bad day at work, I reread Daniel's note. And it reminded me why we were here and the impact higher education can have in not only changing the life of one student, but changing the life of that family. And it was so meaningful. So, you know, your question about how can we inculcate more of that?
Let me just ask, like, how much money do you think you raised in that after?
It was $20,000. I can tell you. Yeah.
And so my point is, like, those same exact donors had you approached with, I'd like to invite you to join us in supporting the institution at the $20,000 level. And these are the things that in general we would use that money for, is like so different than, can you help Daniel? It is such a perfect example of like the ultimate restricted fund, right? We're talking about the most restricted gift this kid needs help today.
Right.
And you hear all of this about, well, we're trying to grow our unrestricted giving. And it's like, why? Like, how do we just find more Daniel-like stories?
Yeah, the stories. Yeah.
So that it feels like you're solving a problem versus throwing, you know, money into a black hole that you feel generally good about, but it's so different than knowing, like, I did that.
Well, so one of the things we did in this situation, because, and, you know, I will also tell you that the student, of course, and gave us permission to tell his story along the way, right? And then he asked, how can I help? And so lesson learned for this small university, we needed an emergency fund and we didn't have one because these things happen. So, you know, Daniel spoke at a scholarship event where we announced that we were going to be creating a fund that would allow for emergency funding at the discretion of the head of admissions in collaboration with the deans if these things came up, because they do. And because we're a small school, we didn't have that kind of money. So we were able to leverage that. Now, because, you know, there are all sorts of tax implications. You can't give money for a specific student, all of that kind of stuff. So in thinking about that, we thought, how can we use this moment? And you're right, that's super inspiring to solve a problem that we didn't really realize we had. We don't have this money in hand. That $20,000 shouldn't have felt like we're not sure we can keep this really talented, deserving kid in school. So, and he was, of course, eloquent and lovely and you know, his story helped us raise the money to create the fund.
Do you know where he is today?
You know, I don't. It's so funny. I was just thinking about this because when I left the School of Drama gave me as a thank you gift this beautiful framed photo of a student production, and he's one of the students in the photo. And I was just thinking, this extraordinary, like, talented group of students, I'd love to know exactly. I know where some of them are. I don't know where he is. So
All right. Well, we're going to do our best to track it down and get him this. And hey, thank you so much
Thank
for
you,
sharing.
Brent.
This is going to be a fun conversation. I look forward to continuing to get to know you and your
You too.
teammates. We're recording this on the Friday before Thanksgiving, so I will wish you a terrific Thanksgiving. And
Thank you.
Thanks again for making time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it, and it was fun.
All right. So with that, I'm going to close today's episode with Suzanne Hilser-Wiles, who serves as president of GGNA. Take care, everybody.